Hi, this is Brennan Davis from Bedrock Games and the Bedrock blog, and I'm here with Kenny, and we're just going to talk about game mastering Wuxia today. So I want to just get right into it, and I think our what was it we wanted to talk about first, Kenny? We're going to go over the differences between running a Wuxia setting versus like a regular setting, right? That was...
Yeah, I think that'd be a good starting point. I mean, if we don't talk about DMing Wuxia, then yeah, we should probably consider why we have to treat it differently to a standard fantasy campaign or space campaign or whatever.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I would agree, and I would also add that I think you want to treat it differently, but you also want to treat it similarly in some respects. So if I don't know, I mean, maybe I'll let you jump in, but I guess my approach is I tend to focus on the characters. Like I see Wuxia as really being about like all of the colorful, larger than life characters in the world they inhabit. And that's the aspect of it that I really try to bring to the table. But I also, mm-hmm. I also try to recognize that it doesn't have to be like so static that you can't bring other elements in once in a while to kind of liven things up. But yeah. You know, I'm curious what your thoughts are. And I should mention, Kenny and I both run Wuxia campaigns separately, but he's also in my my Monday campaign. So we have a slightly different approaches in how we handle these things. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, you know, with your comments about the character focus. I mean, that's a very good point because in Wuxia, more than the other genres, you have to focus on the characters and their quirks, and you know, the NPCs need life in them. Otherwise, it sort of just evolves into a list of techniques that you sort of spew out one after another, and you counter techniques, and you know, it becomes less. Maybe some people might like that, but in my opinion, it becomes less of an enjoyable experience if you take away the sort of the melodrama of the characters, and utilizing their quirks to push the parties in different ways, and that's the way I see it anyway. So,
no, I think melodrama is the right word. That's really, I think, one of the big differences. Like, I feel like in a Wuxia campaign, you can kind of get away with more melodrama and more, like, you know, stuff that might not necessarily fly in a fantasy campaign. Yeah. In terms of like some of the motivations that the NPCs might have, you can kind of go a little over the top in a Wuxia campaign, and it feels like it fits, which is one of the things that I like about it. But I guess also. There's also the sort of the question, like I've run a lot of Wuxia campaigns leading up to this, and initially I used to find that they tended to die after a while. Like a lot of times I think when you run something that's outside of sort of the tried and true sort of, you know, fantasy, horror, or whatever it is for role playing games,
yeah.
It can be sometimes harder to get it off the ground. And so I would tend to find. I'm sorry?
Yeah, it tends to sort of fizzle out because, either people drop out of groups or there's not much left to sustain the story and the setting sort of gets stale and that sort of thing for them, right?
I think like all those things. And I just noticed that it would tend to die out after, I don't know, after a few months. The story might fizzle out or something. And I kind of noticed that online, like that seemed to be what a lot of people not necessarily complained about, but they just assumed that was the length that a Wuxia camp, you know, like it's not meant for anything more than that length, or they would just acknowledge that it would die after a period of time. Not everybody, but I heard that a lot. And so my approach has been to run it more like a standard game in order to kind of, you know, like still run it like Wuxia, but realize that like it, you know, just like fantasy isn't always pure fantasy. You can sometimes bring other things into it. I've sort of found that with Wuxia as well. And not getting as wrapped up, like I think here we have slightly different styles. So I'm kind of curious, what your approach has been here. But for me, one of the things that tends to make it harder for me to keep a campaign going is if I focus more on the story than the characters. And so I find by just dealing with the characters in the setting and not worrying too much about like where the plot threads are going, mm-hmm. that sort of frees me up so that I can somehow just keep the game going, even if the threads don't all meet up at the end. I try to kind of keep enough of the genre elements in place that they still crop up. And I feel like you eventually, you know, look back and you see these sort of storylines that did emerge, but not mm-hmm. all of them kind of reached a natural fruition or had a had an arc to them that was clear.
Right.
And so for me, that's worked. But I know that you like a little bit more story in your game. So I'm just curious, you know, what your approach is there.
Yeah. So for me, I like to give the players sort of freedom as well to do what they want to do. And, you know, that sort of raise an issue or two or with my players, because I might give certain people a bit too much focus. You know, they're off having their own little adventure while everybody's doing their own thing. And, you know, the, splitting the party, I guess that it's a general issue in tabletop role-playing, right? So, splitting the party, you always have to sort of juggle the priorities and make sure everybody's got their own, you know, had a fair share of time, so to speak. But, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm sort of railroading people together, keeping them together at all times, but there's like a sort of fine sort of balance there for me as well. I mean, especially in Wuxia, you know, especially people... You know, it can very quickly pop out, jump over a few roofs, and go steal some herbs from the medicine store or whatever, right? You know, and be back before anyone knows it. But that process sounds simple, but there's lots of, like, you know, little details, like how you're getting in, like, and lots of die rolling involved. And it feels like that person's getting much more action. And if the rest of the party aren't taking as much initiative to be a sort of a lone adventurer in that sense, then, you know, that they're limited to what they can do in the group.
Yeah, I think that's a problem that a lot of campaigns can have, regardless of genre, is the issue of how much attention each player is getting at the table and what to do when the party splits. I deal with that. I kind of play it by ear with the players. For me, like, I know on my Sunday game, the party's been split for almost three sessions now. One party's in the north, one player's in the north, and the rest are in the south. That's a sort of rare. That's not my comfort zone as a GM, for sure. Once in a while, it sometimes happens out of necessity or whatever. But when that occurs, you really have to work hard to split the time, because the guy that's in the north, if he's just sitting there twiddling his thumbs for an hour and a half, while the players in the south are dealing with some exciting things. The other issue that raises is it requires more prep, because you now have two things happening. So
yeah.
So I think I don't see having a central conceit that keeps the party together necessarily being a railroad. I think of that as sort of, that's just something that that's sort of like part of the agreement that everybody at the table sort of decides upon at the start of the campaign, like what kind of game they want. So for me, railroading would be more like, you know, they avoid an obvious hook and you keep throwing that hook at them.
Right.
To make sure it happens, or you know, I don't know, just, you know, or you reconfigure elements that, like, they go south, but it doesn't matter because they still bump into the haunted house that you had set up in the north, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that sort of thing is okay, I think. I mean, they wouldn't have known it was in the north anyway, right? So you're just making sure that your prepared material isn't going to waste because they've decided to turn left instead of turn right.
Well, but see that's I think where, for me, what I would do in that situation is I would just not have the haunted house adventure emerge in the game until they went north. But I think my prep style is very fast and loose, so I tend to have a lot of different regions mapped out in advance and some general ideas of what could happen. And then if the players go to the north and they encounter the haunted house, fine. But I try not to marry myself to the idea, unless it's a rare example of something like I'm playtesting something specific and I tell the players, like, look, I'm playtesting this. Do you want in on it? But yeah, I don't know.
So yeah, I was going to say, like, I think I've mentioned this before as well, that the material, I mean, the whole setting is, you know, you're perhaps more familiar, way more familiar with it than I would ever be, having written most of it. And for me, you know, if players try to, you know, walk off the beaten path, it becomes a bit of an issue, because I can't off the top of my head think of, okay, what's the best way to deal with this? I mean, sure, there are sort of encounter tables and they have their own grudges that might pop up and need resolving. But there's only, you know, so much you can do. Okay, sorry guys, I can't run anymore because I haven't prepared for you to to take these options.
Oh, I get, okay, I get you. No, and I should mention we're talking about Ogregate now. So like, you know, when do you run your game, by the way? You have it on, is it a week?
I do it in person. Yeah, usually we get together once or twice a month, you know, meet face to face and spend an afternoon playing it.
Yeah, I mean, in that situation, because that is sort of a big difference. I have like the material is like I have it all in like note form in my binder, and you know I'm obviously going to be more familiar with it. And for you, you know, you're going to have to look it up. And you might not have what you need on your fingertips. I think what I would tend to do in those, I tend to run everything around the sex rather than the locations. So what I find is helpful is to focus, and I don't know if it would apply to your situation, but focusing on the sex and the NPCs in the sex. And that way it almost doesn't matter what the locations are. Cause there's, you know what I mean? Like like I said, like the melodrama and all the conflict that's unfolding, it can happen anywhere. It can happen on a mountaintop, or it can happen in the south or in the north. So that's, you know, probably a little bit of an easier thing to focus on than if.
Yeah, I think I sort of like went down a different path in that, oh my god, they've deviated from, yeah, the sort of setting. I better make my own city, fill it with my own NPCs, and then, yeah, sort of get bogged down and, yeah, trying to make them make as much sense as what you know, all the other characters that have shown up in the setting and story.
But I think that's fine, because like one of the things I'm realizing, like, I mean, you've seen the map, and like the map doesn't have like if you look at a map of like historical China and compare it to our setting, there's way more cities on a map of historical China than there are in the setting. And that's because I'm assuming that there's, you know, that not all the cities are mapped, that they're, oh sorry, not all the cities are mapped. So making your own city is totally within keeping of the spirit of the game, I think.
Yeah, and what I actually did was I took an existing city and sort of repurposed it for my own use, because, you know, I probably treated like the map of the setting too seriously, in the sense that, you know, okay, this is what the map is, I'm gonna stick with this, and yeah, that's probably limited myself in quite a big way, I guess. It means I feel like I have a bit less freedom to tweak about, because the setting itself is, yeah, everything is very well written. There's lots of little pieces hidden away that can serve as hooks into their little adventure, and sort of deviating from that and, you know, and accidentally overwriting something, for example, feels like it's a bit of a pity from my point of view. So I like to try and keep everything that's there, you know, that all the thought that's been put into it, you know, certain characters being reclused over here, or that sort of, you know, all the little conflicts in the area, mines that are, yeah, being fought over and that sort of thing. It's, yeah, it's nice to keep those little touches in there, because it's part of the world, I guess, and from my point of view. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, feel free to make, you know, people should definitely feel free to make up cities or towns or whatever they want, but, you know, I'm happy if they like the setting too. But yeah, I don't know, I suppose, you know, maybe switching topics a little bit, just because this is something that I think we've both talked about a lot, and it's the some of the challenges of running Wuxia with different levels of understanding of the genre operating at the table. And I'm curious what you've found, you know, with your experience running these kind of games.
Yeah, so I definitely have that in my group. There's one guy who's very familiar with all the tropes and the sort of scenarios, and is very familiar with the Wuxia genre. And the others, not so much. I mean, they've seen probably Hollywood movies of what they think is Wuxia, and and that's the limit of their knowledge. So, and it shows in their playstyle. I think they all go into it with sort of different expectations on how the game's going to play out. I mean, the guy who's really familiar with all the Wuxia stuff, he sort of plays it like he's the main character in the series.
Okay.
So, you know, he's going to be trying to... doing all the clever, witty things, preparation, setting traps, and trying to get the ultimate secret techniques, and sort of make himself more powerful in that way. Whereas the other players, they tend to be more okay. The plot says this. She didn't say that there was anything else. They didn't pick up on the little subtleties that that potentially they could utilize, maybe learn a technique from someone or ally with someone in a particular way. And these sort of little things that because they're not familiar with, the genre and thus how the NPCs would react to certain suggestions or actions. It's a little bit lost on them sometimes. So they treat it as like, well, if they're not hacking and slashing, then they're not really doing much, which, it's a bit of a shame, because I feel like in Wuxia there is much more space for all this sort of like intrigue stuff that my players are sort of skipping out on, and the NPC interactions as well. Yeah, that they sort of miss out on the little quirks and the hints that I drop here and there.
Well, I think too, every group's going to be pretty diverse like that. I've had the same exact thing, and so I think one of the big challenges is as a GM, you have to generally run a game like this for a mixed group. Some people that know about Wuxia, some people that don't. And I guess the solution that I found is to give people, viewing suggestions and things like that to help them understand the genre better. Because I think that you're right. Like, when people don't understand some of the subtleties of the genre, a lot of opportunities get missed, or you can just look weird because you're doing like an eccentric Wuxia NPC, and it would make sense if they sort of had seen a character like Devil Granma from Magic Blade, but yeah. if they haven't seen that kind of stuff, they might just think that you're just being really strange with your characters.
Or that you're trying to be a dickish GM and making things difficult for no reason.
Well, that's the other thing, because in the genre, like some of the characters in the genre are really nasty, like really, really nasty and mean and underhanded. And I think it's important to sometimes bring that to the table in the game. You know what I mean? Like, this is a genre where people get poisoned all the time. And So I think if players aren't as familiar with the genre, they can misperceive it as you're being a bit of a jerk when like somebody throws some poison needles at them, or when somebody pretends to be all nice and then tricks them at the last minute. There's a lot of these little things that crop up in the genre. But when you do have a player who doesn't know about the genre, what's your method of helping them along?
I mean, I always so what I do is before I even run the campaign, I sort of tell them, try to tell them a bit about the setting and the genre, and explain to them that because it's a Wuxia setting, you may not necessarily see or be exposed to the same sort of interactions that you would in a fantasy campaign. They sort of take that in the stride and go, yeah, sure, whatever you throw at me, we'll roll with it. But even so, when I do something particularly, I think the word we use is hammy or over dramatic type of thing, then they still like give me looks at saying, really, that's what you're gonna do? It's like, well, that's what the characters and that's what the setting would do. I mean, they would laugh and then detonate all the bombs in the area and that sort of thing.
Right? No, I know exactly what you mean, and I've seen that very reaction from players. And it's always interesting to see that the players who are more familiar with it immediately get what you're doing, and the players that are less familiar might have a harder time with it. Especially stuff like the laughing.
Yeah.
The laughing is like that's a thing, obviously, and it can seem a little jarring to players if they don't And also when you have these, again, it depends on what you're sort of drawing on for inspiration, but villains that are like truly villains, like just like bad guys, those are, in fantasy campaigns, especially now, they might tend to be more, I don't know what the word, more subtle in their villainy. And in
Oh
wuxia,
yes.
it can be very sort
It's
of,
full on.
yeah.
Yeah. It's very full. I mean, you do have your, sneaky scholarly villains who work in the background and ruin everything for the party, but then, most of them are probably the whole, seize power by force thing and be unassailable in their fortress. And they're regarded by their seven disciples who who all are definitely loyal to the master for some reason,
Yeah.
and that sort of thing, yeah.
Well, one thing I think one thing that's important with that is I do like to make, because I think this is kind of something that you see a lot in the genre, so you really have to kind of adhere to it, is the end when you do have a villain or you have a bad guy in a game like this, not all the time, but a lot of the time, if they're cunning, they need to be legitimately cunning. Do you know what I mean? Like they need to have like legitimate contingency plans in place. They need to really think things through. Because I mean, it's the kind of thing where like in these movies and these books, the characters face foes that will be 10 steps ahead of them sometimes,
Yeah.
and so I that's something that I try to bring to the table when I'm running a wuxia game, is that level of cunning that I think like the really great villains have, and sort of the I don't know I just I love when it's I like villains and I like bad guys, so. In Wuxia, I love when they sort of pull tricks on the heroes, and so I like to bring that into the game. But again, you do have to be mindful of how familiar your players are with those sort of things.
Yeah, and I think, so for the players who aren't that familiar with the genre, I sort of hand wave a bit the level of respect or sort of the seniority issues that might crop up here and there. I mean, I the concept, they might have a vague understanding of respect your elders or whatever, but the levels of seniority, paying respect to your uncle, master, that type of thing, and that's probably not something that they're very familiar with, and I sort of let it slide sometimes just because I know that it's not something they're used to saying every time. They're not going to bow, it's say that they're going to bow every time in front of, when they greet them, or have the proper addressing, and just letting them walk first, that type of thing. And I didn't expect my players to do that, but it's nice when they do because it shows that they have, so they've sort of kept that in mind as a factor that can impact how the NPCs in the world view your party, and how they might react to what you're saying as well. So, and that's so yeah, like I just hand waves it sometimes and just assume that they're being respectful, but maybe not in the way they're role playing it,
Well, I mean that's a good topic too, because that's something that I mean I've that comes up a lot in these kind of games, and it is something that I see a lot of players sort of have difficulty with, even when they understand it. Like it can make them very uneasy because they're not it's just not a topic that they either are familiar with or they haven't seen it much. So I don't know, what do you usually tell your players when you start? Like how do you explain that to them? Or do you just kind of, like you said, like you don't really worry about it too much?
I don't worry about it too much. I mean, I tell them that, ancient China, there's a whole level of hierarchy that people tend to obey, and seniority is important. But if you, I don't expect you to understand exactly how Chinese culture works and what sort of actions you need to take to show that you're filial piety, that type of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, bear it in mind if you can, and if it comes up, if an opportunity arises to utilize it, then by all means do it. But I'm not going to penalize you unless you're way out of line.
Well, and also, I found you can incrementally introduce things like that, so that you don't it, you deal with that in bits and pieces over time, and sometimes that can be a good way to do it. Or I introduced a magic item that was based around propriety, and it would only work if the user adhered to rules of propriety, and so that was kind of a my clever way of of getting the player to pay more attention to that stuff. You know, yeah. Not that this player had any particular issue with it, but it just brought it into the game, and suddenly it was a thing that they could kind of, you know, when there's a bonus involved, you know, players will sometimes, you know, pay more attention to that stuff. So,
yeah, definitely. Yeah, and you know, it is you know, it's a bit difficult for people from a Western sort of upbringing to understand this sort of seniority thing and understand how important your Shifu actually is to you know, you as your life as a martial artist and you as a person in as a character in the setting. And yeah, you know, some of my players, you know, they seem to be pretty happy to just, oh, let's just leave the sect at the drop of a hat, and you know, let's do their own thing, you know, take on another master, do everything, right? And in those sorts of situations, it gets a bit, you know, it's like, well, I kind of have to punish them for it, so you know, I make things difficult for them one way or another. Maybe they're now outcasts of their sect, and you know, they have to, and I can make a little plot arc out of that. But yeah, it's hard to impress on them just how big of a decision leaving a sect and betraying your Sifu actually is.
No, that is, and it's something too that I think when it happens, one thing that I will sometimes do is I'll sort of break that fourth wall and say, look, like, this is something you know is going to be monumental if you do it, so you know, go ahead, do it if you want, but like, this is sort of the cultural line that you're crossing right now. But also it is something that I guess like the genre has a lot of, like, there is sort of that independent streak in a lot of the wuxia genre. So you know, you have characters like in Return of Condor Heroes where, you know, he's kind of, you know, in a lot of ways he's very noble and adheres to some of these rules, but in other ways he just constantly is, you know, breaching them. And so I think there's room for it in the campaign, but you kind of, there's still, the world needs to react accordingly. Like, just like in Return of Condor Heroes, when the Shifu and the disciple become a thing and sort of become romantically involved, it's scandalous and like everybody hates them. And so when I have a group, like I have a group on Sunday that they had two Shifus that were like, that like united and formed like a big organization. And then they murdered them both, and they did it in secret. So there was no, you know, they were at least smart enough to like not, you know, completely do it openly, but it wasn't so secret that rumors didn't start to spread. And so it started to affect their reputation, and the way that it impacted the game was they just had a really hard time recruiting new people into their sect when they desperately needed new people in their sect, because they were in the middle of like two sect wars. And so that kind of hammered. So, you know, they were totally free to kill their Shifus, but there was this, you know, this cloud that hung over them after and still hangs over them now, just because of the whispers in the martial world.
Yeah, it's definitely, yeah, something you wouldn't see in a fantasy campaign. Like, you know, a wizard betraying their mentor, for example, doesn't elicit that much of a reaction from the people around them, right? You know, it's sort of viewed as mildly reasonable, to some sense, degree anyway. But definitely in a Wuxia campaign, that sort of thing doesn't fly, and it should have the sort of consequences that you're suggesting here.
Yeah, and I think the way to do it is do it without, you know, inform the players what's what, and then, like, if they want to do something, don't stop them, but have it, you know, have repercussions in the setting. You know, their character might totally reject that line of reason. They might not see the value of the hierarchy, but everybody else does. So, you know, that's where I think, you know, the setting will kind of bring it in that way. But it is a tricky one, because it, like you said, it's something that not, you know, especially if they're just not familiar with the culture, it's going to be hard for them to kind of grok. But again, you know, I think over time people do sort of pick up on it. But yeah, I don't know. Let me see. What do you think in terms of preparation for a game? Like, is there anything that you do differently to prepare for a Wuxia game than you would for a regular fantasy game or a Cthulhu
I mean,
type beast.
I feel like, the Wuxia NPCs, they don't, I feel like they don't necessarily need as much preparation, in advance anyway. Like, you can definitely develop the characters as you go, but having some a basic idea of, what sort of NPC you want, and then, adding bits and pieces as you go along, and then perhaps build a backstory for them if the players inquire enough is enough. Whereas in sort of fantasy campaigns, sometimes you have to start from the backstory. Okay, so why is this person here? And then you sort of you dig like a 100-foot hole behind them to try and work out, what led to them being here, and how they can what they will be doing for the players, and what the players can do for them. But Wuxia, the characters are very important, but they don't necessarily have to be fully fleshed out. Just need a concept and, core character traits. If someone's going to be a fiery swordswoman who doesn't suffer fools, that's usually enough for you to play off of.
I would agree. They can be more, I mean, I hate to use this word, but they can be a little bit, initially they can be a little more two-dimensional until they have some airtime, it seems. Like they can, because the thing is, I think the reason, it's not that characterization is less important in Wuxia, but it's that characters, there's a lot of characters in Wuxia stories, and a lot of times they just make an appearance in one fight. Like they show up and they get cut down, and you still get a really solid impression of who what the character's all about. So for the amount of screen time they're getting, they actually get a lot of characterization. It's just that there's so much of them. You need, like you kind of need to quickly assign features to them and then throw them at the party. And then if they survive, they sort of earn the right to have
Have
more.
backstory, yeah. Otherwise, you'd be spending like 2 hours on a character, with the most amazing tragic backstory, and then they just die in the fourth round of combat or something. You're like, well, there we go. That's the end
I mean,
of that.
sometimes I will do backstories like that, but I'll again, you have to, you have to accept that when you do that stuff, they might get cut down and it might never emerge. So it's sort of like, you have to decide, do I want to spend the time on this? But like, another thing that I sometimes do for backstory is I kind of do like the event before the campaign started. Like there was some, before the characters even ever entered the martial world, some great, terrible thing happened. And I have like, and so it'll be something that if the players choose to interact with it, it'll slowly emerge over the course of play. They'll slowly meet the people involved, and it might happen because they found an item that was important, and then they find the person who the item belonged to, and the person who was the that person's lost love, and because of a misunderstanding, their son died, like all kinds of little things. But
Yeah, so in sort of Wuxia settings as well, that sort of thing is very common. Like manuals that were hastily stuffed in an ape or something, casually gets found by the main character for the next part of the story. Conveniently, I mean, that sort of stuff happens if you don't sort of add that to your preparation before running the campaign. I guess it'll be hard to come up with that sort of stuff on the fly. And but at the same time, there's a fine balance between setting a backstory and having stuff for players to find, and sort of deus ex machinaing things just so the players can have it, for example.
Just so there's, I didn't catch that.
So it's just so the players can have something. You're literally putting something out of your ass so that the players have this coincidental encounter of some sort, and
Oh,
that's
I
when
get.
sort of I draw the line there. But it's a very fine line to sort of toe, because having all the you have all these like things prepared, obviously you want your players to find it right all the time, and either you guide them a bit too obviously towards it, or you just spring it on them just so that they have it. And
I guess how I do it, I tend to take a light hand on it. So my attitude is most of the stuff I prep is going to be very sort of, these are like, for the bare bones essential stuff I need for play. And the when I do backstory stuff like that, I do it like if I'm introducing a character, I might think of them like, this is kind of a bad metaphor, but like peaks of of different mountaintops. Do you know what I mean? Like I have this character here, this character here, this character here, and together they all kind of form like a landscape. that, you know, that the players can explore if they choose, but it's not ever an essential thing. You know, a lot of those characters will just vanish off into the ether, you know, or get killed, and then nobody ever bothers to explore what happened to them. But what I like to be possible is, like, say they have an encounter with somebody who's after them for some reason. If they dig a little bit deep, maybe they find out more about that person. It's something interesting. And then, you know, and then they can go explore it. But they don't necessarily, I think what's important from the player point of view is feeling like whatever they're doing, it's not something that they have to do. If it's, you know, if they, you know, that's why I think you don't want to put so much effort into it that you've wasted like 8 hours prepping for something that's never going to happen. Just enough so that if the players dig in, you can give them some material that's interesting and shows that there's some kind of foundation there that feels real. So, you know, again, like, and it's usually fairly simple things. Like, in my Saturday game, the player character's mother became a member of the party. And so then I thought about it. I was like, okay, well, I need to give this person a little bit of backstory because it's the mother. So I gave her a secret where her and the husband, and I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but they somehow entered it. They were Yenli priests who ended up in a conflict with another heroic couple who were much more advanced than they were. And the end result of the conflict was that this character's mother and father, mainly through chicanery, were able to kill the husband of the heroic couple and their son. And now and then they went into hiding because and changed their name and pretended that they didn't exist anymore. And this woman, the widow that was left behind, ended up tracking them down and you know, wanting revenge. And so by the time she, you know, appeared in the role of a die in the session, there was this whole backstory for the characters to find out about when they, you know, were like, well, who the hell is this woman that's coming after us? So stuff like that I kind of like to do. But again, I think you got, you know, that was one that was more surefire because that was the character's mother. So obviously it's going
to
come up.
Yeah, your effort was going to be rewarded either way. Yeah.
But if it's not that certain, I think, you know, you just kind of get the pinpoints of the backstory and thread it as quickly as you can and then leave it there. And if it comes up, it comes up. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Kind of like you were saying with the NPCs, like just enough for whatever you're going to need. You know, you don't want to underprepare, but you don't want to overprepare because you're just going to waste your time.
Yeah, and as I say, like, much of the sort of fun I see from a Wuxia setting is the character interactions with each other and with the NPCs. And sometimes if you let the players just do their own thing, situations can arise out of that better than you can prepare for, right? I mean, yeah, I guess using our sorts of sessions as examples, and we had the whole sort of argument with the character who was trying to steal everything from the whole party and that sort of thing. Yeah, they're not things you really plan for. It just happened because you let the players, you know, let's talk it out among themselves, and then it suddenly pops up, and you have a bit of a plot point that sort of lasts you for half an hour, and comes up again at some point further down the campaign.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, yeah, I think if you have a lot of stuff prepped and in your head, and that's all you're thinking about, it's harder to notice the things that the players just naturally are finding on their own. And so, like, you might be, you know, you might not realize, oh, something just came up on the fly that totally makes sense here that we can just go with. And so if you're so stuck on your prepared material, and again, that's why I think focusing on the characters and the groups rather than the events is the way to go. Like don't think, oh, X has to happen during play. Think, one armed fiery demon really wants to get the crown of such and such, you know, by the end of the month. And as long as you know that about One Armed Fiery Demon and the players happen to have that crown, you know some of the things that she's likely to do, and there are ways for you to introduce her, but you don't have to think, oh, at the bridge, she has to be standing there to confront them because
waiting.
I know, yeah.
And then, waiting in the cool pose.
Yeah, and they didn't go to the bridge, so now what do I do? They went the other way. You know, they're like if you're only thinking about the characters, then you can think, okay, well, you know, she's trying to follow them. What are her chance? Like, you can assign a chance of her success to her or whatever, give her a survival role or something, but figure out, you know, how well she's following the party. And when they do change direction, if is she able to determine that they did that? And then can she somehow catch up to them? And, you know, I think that's a, again, if you focus on things through the characters, because, and the characters are sufficiently motivated, the drama and the melodrama and all that stuff tends to happen just by, you know, chemistry of, you know, this person wants this thing, this person wants this thing, and they inevitably clash or ally and then, you know, clash with somebody else. So, so I think that's one of the reasons why I really like to focus on the characters. And I mean like NPCs, NPC and player characters as well.
Yeah, definitely.
But I don't know. I guess one of the other things about the genre and again, this does very much depend on the system you're using, but I think it's inherent in the genre, is power levels and expectations of the players. You know that.
Yeah, that's lots of players. You know, even if they're not min-maxing, they don't like to make a weak character. And yeah, some of my character, my players have sort of figured out, you know, if you're early level, if it's a low level campaign, then you probably should just put a primary in defense, otherwise you're probably gonna suffer a lot through early combat. And yeah, and they've sort of reached a conclusion as well that all the knowledge skills and the specialist skills that don't directly help them are basically useless, and that specializing their points in that area is a waste as well. So they're sort of left with just the physical stuff or their mental stuff and then their combat stuff. And you know, we sort of talked about the fact that you can sort of add different things to a Wuxia setting. You know, you can have intrigue, you can have horror, and those things are all possibilities. But I think because usually the players, they're so used to their concept of Wuxia is, oh, people kung fu fighting, and then everything else is sort of just haze in the background. So they don't sort of assign the that level of importance to, say, compared to D&D, where having charisma checks, for example, is very good skill to have. But I very rarely see anyone with persuade in Wandering Heroes, for example, despite the fact that I think it would be, you know, it's a really good skill to have. And if you're having sort of any social interactions at all, usually people just sort of resort to violence. And I don't know if you sort of see that in your campaigns as well. But
I see it all over the map. I mean, I think it really depends on the players. I think the first thing is the knowledge is they can become really important depending on what's going on. So like, the very first campaigns I ran, nobody ever put points into any of their knowledge skill. That was like the most barren area of the character sheet. And that was pretty much followed by survival, which almost never got any ranks. And you learn pretty quickly, oh crap, you need survival. You got to have survival or you like have encounters all the time. So people started putting dots into survival. But when they began to realize that, oh, knowledge about, and this will tend to happen, especially if like there's sect conflict or there's just things they need to know. But, you know, knowing about rival sects can be really useful. Knowing about different religious things can be really useful. Knowing about places can be helpful. So when that stuff would come up, I would notice players start to assign more points into those areas. I think if you want intrigue and stuff like that, intrigue tends to happen easiest, I think, when players have obtained power. So if they're still kind of like low on the totem pole in organization, or they're just not as involved with, you know, the managerial level of a sect, say, then they're just not at a point where they're as invested in any intrigue that might surround the sect.
That makes sense.
Once they have something to lose, like, you know, as soon, like, you know, you might not care about the intrigue, but then, you know, if you become second chief or third chief, you're going to start caring the moment people start, doing tricky things in the background and trying to undermine the reputation of the sect, or
Yeah.
who knows what. Or you could even become the target of a campaign of misinformation, or so I find that the intrigue stuff arises as the players gain more power, and then that's sort of when.
Yeah, so that perhaps that's why I've not really seen much of that is that my characters are still pretty low level. I think they're G3, so they've not had any chance to amass actual followers and power of their own. So at the moment they're still following the whole wandering hero trope that they are a band of ragtag people who is trying to eke out a living in the perils of Jianghu.
I think also you had mentioned mystery too, and I think I run a lot of mystery adventures, a lot of investigative type adventures, or I have at least. And I think when you do that, that's one, like, I tend to think of myself as running two types of campaigns. I either run them the way that you've seen me generally run them, where it's like very character focused and very sort of all about, kind of sandboxy in a way, or I run a mystery. And when I run a mystery, I do a lot more like my preparation for a mystery is very different from my preparation. So if I know I'm planning a mystery, even if I don't know whether the players are going to actually get involved in it, I take a slightly different approach to how I plan it out. Because I think with a mystery, you do need, like, okay, there has to be an actual mystery, and there has to be like a potential way for the players to follow different trails of clues, and you have to have that stuff kind of mapped out in some way, or it's very hard to run the mystery on the fly. So so the mystery adventures, I tend to map out how, like all of the locations where you can find clues and information. And I think if you do that and you have a sufficient hook, then you might see mystery emerge. I suppose if you're making a mystery and then your players are just slicing through it, that's a different thing. I don't know.
It's also the fact that sometimes mystery is one of those things where it sounds nice to just drop it in drop it in the mid campaign, but at that point if the players they haven't put any points into anything that would help them, any reasoning or the correct sort of detect things or the right knowledge skills, then it sort of puts them on the spot in that they have to now try to scavenge these points together between them.
That's true, though I would say this, when I think when I mean, there are different kinds of players. So some players, when you run a mystery, there are some players who want to play a mystery, and I would say as a simulation of a mystery, like they want to simulate the experience of Sherlock Holmes. So for those kind of players, rolling their knowledge skill rolls are very important. Having a character that has different skill sets and seeing those play out over the mystery is important. But the other type of players want to solve the mystery themselves, and I think that's a difference. So, and you kind of have to cater a little bit to both types of players, because typically you're going to have both in your group. So I think when you run mysteries, having the players, the stats and stuff can be important, but there can be other ways for the players to kind of solve it with their like as themselves in a way, like, sort of, you know what I mean? Because that's kind of the fun of the mystery. You're not really experiencing the fun of it vicariously through your character. You want to experience the revelations yourself. You don't want to be, you don't want to just be acting out the surprise that your character is experiencing. And so, one way to get around that, and it's the same way that I get around a lot of issues like the survival roles, is they can always go to other people, and like they might not know about a particular religion that's significant to finding a clue, but they can go find a priest
An NPC
and
helper, basically,
yeah. Well, they can go and look, as they need, they can go and ask experts in the city. Like there should be people around that might be able to answer some of the questions they have if they're finding that, oh, they can't answer a particular question because they don't have the knowledge skill that's required. But also when you're making a mystery, I mean, you have the ability to make whatever clues you want. So you can make it as easy or as hard for the party as you want to.
Yeah.
So there's always that. You can always say, well, I'm not going to make it overly reliant on knowledge skills. I'm going to make it a mystery that that can be solved largely by just kind of, putting the pieces together and looking around the crime scene and then, asking the right questions. I think that's something
Yeah.
else that comes up. Like, if you're solving a mystery and they're interrogating people, they're asking people questions, that's the kind of thing where what the character's saying is going to be really important, and what they're asking is going to be really
Yeah,
important.
because sometimes when these sort of interrogations happen, it's just like, I really wish the players would ask this question so I can give them this clue and try and like lead the conversation towards that. But if they never pick up on it, then it's like, well, there goes
Well,
that clue.
you know what can be handy? There's a long history of debate over how to run murder mysteries and how, like the best way to do them. There's some really good articles by The Alexandrian online that I always suggest to people, because I think he has like the three clue rule, and he's got a few other articles that I think that sort of address how to handle mysteries in a standard type of role-playing game that doesn't have some of the things that like Gumshoe game has. But one of the things that I do, because you're sort of getting to that whole idea of, well, the players have stumbled upon a bottleneck in the adventure, or they've hit upon an area where they can't really get past a certain clue. I add an additional element, which is what I call like the countdown threat. So I have, and I don't do this for every mystery adventure, but I do it for a lot of them. And the idea is, whether the players solve the mystery or not, it's going to be an exciting evening of play, because there's some threat in the game that the longer the players take to get to the bottom of the mystery, it becomes increasingly hostile to them, or increasingly likely to do something really bad. So it's
Yeah.
kind of like in 24, where you have like the terrorist that like plants the bomb in like the
Oh yeah.
stadium. Like, whether he solves it or not, something really exciting is going to happen, at like the 24-hour mark. So
Yeah.
you kind of do that. And then what you can do is you can say, okay, if they don't solve it by then and the exciting event happens, then that kind of flips the adventure on its head. And all of these other things start happening that they suddenly have to deal with. So that's sort of how I deal with that. But there are ways to deal with that so that you don't, so like the rule of three thing, which is the Alexandrian, is that you make sure that there's always three clues at any scene, and that way, they don't get stuck on that one clue that they can't solve. There's
Yeah.
multiple clues. And I also try to think, okay, I have my sort of map of where the clues are and where they can be found, but players will propose things that, you might not have thought of, but they're actually plausible ways to solve the mystery. Do you know what I mean? Like, they might say, oh,
Yeah.
well, obviously the guy's got a grandmother, so I'm going to go talk to his grandmother and see what she has to say. And you might not have given any thought to the grandmother, but you can pretty quickly say, oh yeah, the grandmother would know X, Y, and Z. And so when they go there and talk to her, that's fine. That's a perfectly reasonable way to get that information.
There's always that sort of thing when I there's the risk that because of that, you've given them like a super easy shortcut to the end of the mystery sometimes, and
Well, I think what you want to do is you want to make sure that it passes the plausibility check. So if it's as long as it's plausible, that's the thing. And again, it depends on what the clue is. Like, what I've tended to do with my mysteries is I've not worried so much about the pacing of them, because I find that the more I worry about that, and the more I like think, oh, am I challenging the players enough? I think a lot of times players don't really care about that as much as the GM does. The players are excited to have just solved the mystery, so
Yeah.
it's not a huge deal if they cut through, as long as they're doing it in the like a way that makes sense and isn't like totally like you're just handing it to them because you want to hand it to them. But like,
Yeah.
as long as like they, you know, they they if they come up with a genuinely clever idea, it's not a sin to reward a clever idea with you know, a good conclusion. So, and I know we're talking about mysteries, but you know, I think it's probably worth pointing out that you know, mysteries are pretty common in Wuxi. Like, there's like a whole, you know, like all those Gulong stories have like a real heavy mystery element. And so I think it's something that I kind of have come to expect from in a Wuxia campaign. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that answers the challenges that you raised there.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, it's definitely something that's very overlooked. Adding these sort of adventures into Wuxia. I mean, the setting material that you've given, that you've written is it has all these options for sort of more fantasy side of things, ghosts and demons and stuff. You know, the first time I tried to bring it up to my players, they were like, "Nope, not going in there. It feels evil. It feels like there's yin energy. Nope. Let's just turn around and go somewhere else." And it's I guess it's getting players to learn as well that just because it's Wuxia, it doesn't necessarily mean it's just all sort of cloak and daggery things. It's the magic and the rituals and that sort of stuff is very prevalent in the setting.
Well, yeah, and I guess I should say, like, the setting, like, I kind of mentioned in the book, but I probably didn't do a good job. Like, it's a combination of, it's not just Wuxia, obviously. It's other genres too that are somewhat related. Like, you know, like I like Wuxia, but I also like a Chinese ghost story. You know, I like being able to kind of blend those things together because I feel like they fit in a campaign. You know, but I do think, you know, you kind of have to decide if that's what you want to do. Like not every GM is going to want to have those elements in it. So I think they're free to limit the supernatural. But I think when you do limit the supernatural, at least in my experience, you have fewer tools. So you have to, you know, it's something to know going in. If I limit it to pure Wuxia, then I just have to know that I have fewer tools to draw on for in terms of what adventures I can throw at them on the fly. But you know, I guess that's all. And you know, again, I think if you're doing sufficiently character-driven stuff, that's not an issue. But
Yeah, that's just I think maybe my players aren't that familiar with sort of like Journey to the West stuff, so maybe their idea of demons is a lot scarier than what my mental image is. Because when I was young, I watched the sort of TV series of Journey to the West, where it's all very cartoonish, and demons are just people who dress like a pig or whatever that sort of thing.
Now, which do you know? Do you happen to know which version that was off the top of your head, or?
It was a Hong Kong TVB version that was like 97 or something like that. Like, it was the more comedic versions of popular versions of it. And that sort of stuff. Bad. You have the bad CG, and then you have the people dressed in very obvious costumes. And that sort of. That level of fantasy is what I would, sort of be trying to push to the players. But when they hear demons and spirits and stuff, then their mind drifts to D&D or Pathfinder type of things, where demons and spirits are high challenge rating opponents that you shouldn't touch unless you're very well prepared. That maybe you need silvered weapons and that sort of stuff. Well, we shall know. You don't really need it.
It can be, yeah. I think that can be a tricky thing, and I think Journey of the West too. It's like, it's. I mean, it's a long story, so it's. So even asking people to, like, you know, brush up on it, you know, it's a. I usually recommend, because I think it's digestible. I usually recommend the Stephen Chow version,
Oh
the
yeah,
Chinese Odyssey one.
movie.
I mean, it's totally like off the wall and stuff, but like it kind of gives people a good introduction to some of the concepts. So, but you know, and I think there's like in English there's a 4-volume version of Journey to the West, which is really good, but there's also like a condensed version that I think. I forget what it's called. I think it's like called Monkey King or something. And it's the same guy who did the 4-volume version, but he just condensed all the bits. But yeah, I don't know. I think those concepts can take a little while to really sink, especially because even if you watch the stuff or read it, it's not necessarily being fully explained. So, you know, they can watch some of these movies, but it's not ex some of the concepts aren't explained fully, so.
Yeah, I think if we use our sort of I guess Monday campaign as an example, I mean, all the players there are very familiar with Xianxia genre. So yeah, when we run into demons, yeah, we're not adverse to trying to deal with them or converse with them, or even just straight out attacking them. Whereas people who might not be that familiar would might not might have, might miss opportunities that would otherwise be available if they were a bit more open-minded, or if they were or weren't so terrified of the concept.
Well, one of the cool things about demons in this kind of setting is they can be reasoned with. Like they can be, I mean, I guess they can be reasoned with in D&D and settings like that, but they're still a demon's not, I mean, you know, you're going to be very reluctant to deal with
They
them.
usually there's a heavy price for sort of dealing with demons in that sort of setting, right?
But I mean, but this is a setting where like you can befriend a demon. Like it's not necessarily like a, you know, it's, I mean, it might
And it's
cause
not a bad
problems.
thing. They may not even be evil. It's just that they have a different appearance. And I guess that's my party actually has someone a player who likes playing the variant races that we have available in Wandering Heroes. So, the first time around he played a Hechi, the goat people, and then this time around he's playing like a Djurin. So, I would have thought that they'd be okay with this sort of this level of fantasy, but no, they still react in a very strong way apparently.
Okay.
So,
I mean, I guess it takes some getting used to. You know what's a good I think Madame Whitesnake is sometimes a good thing to throw at people if they're not quite getting a handle on that. Because that can kind of show, okay, like, you know, like here's an example of like a mortal that like falls in love with a demon. And you know, it just kind of it just shows that they're like an they're not quite the same concept as they are in the West.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think we've covered a lot today, and we've gone for almost over an hour. So I think we'll sign off and we'll come back on. And if anybody, you know, listens and wants us to talk about something else next time, definitely let us know, and we'll think about addressing that. But I don't know, do you have anything that you wanted to mention before we go, Kenny?
No, yeah, just thanks for having me on, and it was a pleasure talking with you.
All right, okay, it was a pleasure as well. And I'm probably gonna, like I said, Kenny's in my Monday game, and one of these days I'm gonna post a one of the Monday game sessions online when we all agree that it's one that's worth putting up. And you'll probably see Kenny back on here in the future as well for other podcasts. So, all right, we're gonna go, and I will talk to you later.